Chapter 3. The other great tale my father told me was of the raid on Dunnet, and I liked all of that one, for it had the happiest of endings. It ended, as far as I was concerned, in me. My father had been a young man in need of a wife. There were people of our lineage at the domains of Corda and Drum. My grandfather had taken pains to keep on good terms with the Cordas, and try to patch over the old ill feelings between Casperos and Drums, not joining forays against them, or letting his people do any cattle raiding or sheep stealing from them. This was out of fellowship with his relations at those domains, and because he hoped his son might find a wife among them. Our gift went from father to son, but no one doubted that a mother of the true line strengthened the gift. So, there being no girl of the true line at the home domain, we looked to Cordamont, where there were a number of young men of our family, though only one marriageable woman. She was 20 years older than Canach. Such a marriage has been made often enough, anything to keep the gift. But Canach hesitated, and before Auric could force the issue, Branta Auga of Drummond demanded the woman for his own youngest son. The Cordas were under Auga's thumb, and gave her to him. That left only the Casperos of Drummond to furnish a bride within the lineage. There were two girls there who would have done well enough, given a few years more to grow up. They would have been glad to marry back into the domain of their kinfolk. But the old hatred between the Drums and the Casperos was strong in Branta Auga. He turned away Auric's advances, scorned his offers, and married the girls off at 14 and 15, one to a farmer and one to a serf. This was a deliberate insult to the girls and to the lineage they came from, and worse yet, a deliberate weakening of our gift. Few people of the domains approved of Auga's arrogance. A fair contest between powers is one thing, an unfair attack on power itself is another. But Drummond was a very strong domain, and Branta Auga did as he pleased there. So there was no woman of the Caspro blood for Canach to marry. As he said to me, "Auga saved me from the old lady at Cordamont and the poor chicken-faced girls at Drummond." So I said to my father, "I'll go raiding." Auric thought he meant raiding the small domains in the glens, or maybe north into Morgamont, which had a reputation for fine horses and beautiful women. But Canach had a bolder venture in mind. He gathered a troop, stout young farmers of Caspermont, a couple of the Caspros of Cordamont and Turnock Rod, and other young men from one domain or another, who thought a little serf-snatching or booty-taking was a fine idea, and they all met one May morning down at the crossways, under the shear, and rode down the narrow track to the south. There had been no raid into the lowlands for 70 years. The farmers wore stiff, thick leather jackets and bronze caps, and carried lance and cudgel and long dagger, in case it came to blood fighting. The men of the lineages wore the black felt kilt and coat and went bare-legged and bare-headed, their long black hair braided and clubbed. They carried no weapon but a hunting knife and their eyes. "When I saw the lot of us, I wished I'd gone first and stolen some of the Morga horses," Canach said. "Would have been a fine sight but for the creatures most of us had to ride. I had King, Roni's sire, a tall red horse that I could just remember. But Turnock was on a droop-lipped plowmare, and all Barto had to ride was a piebald pony with a blind eye. The mules were handsome, though, three of the fine ones father bred. We led them. They were to carry home our loot." He laughed. He was always light-hearted telling this story. I imagine the little procession, the grim, bright-eyed young men on plodding horses, jingling in file down the narrow, grassy, rock-strewn track out of the uplands into the world below. Mount Arran would have risen up behind them when they looked back, and Barrack, with its grey crags, and then at last looming higher than all, the Carantages, white-crowned and huge. Before them, as far as the eye could see, lay grassy hills. "Green as beryl," my father said, his eyes looking back into the memory of that rich, empty land. On the first day of riding, they met no one, saw no sign of man, no cattle or sheep, only the quail and the circling hawk. The lowlanders left a wide margin between themselves and the mountain folk. The raiders rode all day at the slow pace of Bartow's purblind pony and camped on a hillside. Only late in the morning of the next day did they begin to see sheep and goats on the stone-fenced hills, then a farmhouse far off, and a mill down in a stream valley. The track grew to a cart road, and to a high road that ran between ploughlands. And then before them, smoke-wreathed and red-roofed on its sunny hillside, stood the town of Dunnet. I don't know what my father intended his raid to be. A sudden, fierce onslaught of warriors falling on terrified townsfolk, or an impressive entry and demands enforced by the threat of dreaded and uncanny powers. Whatever he had imagined doing, when he came there he led his troop to the city and into the streets, not at a gallop, shouting and brandishing weapons, but sedately in order. So they went all but unnoticed among the crowds and flocks and wagons and horse herds of a market day until they were right in the central square and marketplace, where suddenly people saw them and began to scream, "Uplanders! Witch folk!" Then some ran to escape or to bar their doors, and others scurried to save their market goods, and those fleeing were trapped in the square by those coming to see what was going on. And there was panic and havoc. Stalls overturned, canopies dragging, frightened horses plunging and trampling, cattle bawling, the farmers of Caspermont brandishing their lances and cudgels at fishwives and tinsmiths. Cannock called them out of this panic, threatening not the townspeople but his own men with his power, till he got them gathered around him, some of them doggedly hanging on to goods they had grabbed from the market stalls, a pink shawl, a copper stewpot. He told me, "I saw that in a blood fight we were lost. There are hundreds of those folk, hundreds." How could he have known what a town was? He had never seen one. "If we went into the houses to loot, we'd be separated, and they'd pick us off one by one. Only Turnock and I had a gift strong enough to attack or defend with. And what were we to take? There was all this stuff, things, everywhere. Food, goods, clothes, no end to it. How could we take all that? What were we after? I wanted me a wife, but I didn't see how that was to be, the way things were there. And the one thing we really need in the uplands is hands to work. I knew if I didn't put a scare into them, and soon, they'd be all over us. So I raised up the parley flag, hoping they knew what it was. They did. Some men showed themselves at the windows of the big house over the marketplace and waved a cloth out the window. Then I called out, 'I am Cannock Caspro of the true lineage of Caspermont, and I have the gift and power to undo, which you shall see me use.' And first I struck one of the market stalls so it fell all to pieces. Then I turned half round, to be sure they saw what I did and how I did it, and I struck the corner of a big stone building across from the house they were in. I held my arm out steady, so they could see. They saw the wall of the building move and bulge, and stone slip down out of it, making a hole in the wall. That grew bigger, and the sacks of grain inside burst open, and the noise of the stones falling was terrible. 'Enough! Enough!' they shouted out. So I ceased to unmake the granary, and turned to them again. They wanted to talk and parley. They asked me what I wanted of them. I said women and boys. There went up an awful howl at that. People in all the streets and houses around shouted, 'No, no, kill the witches!' There were so many of them, their voices were like a storm of wind. My horse jumped and screamed. An arrow had just nicked his rump. I looked up into the window above the one where the men were parleying, and saw an archer leaning far out the window to draw his bow again. I struck him. His body fell like a sack from the window to the stones below, and burst. Then I saw a man at the edge of the crowd of people caught in the marketplace stoop and come up with a stone in his hand, and I struck him. I unmade his arm only. It fell to his side limp as a string. He began to scream, and there was a wailing and panic where the archer had fallen. "I will unmake the next man who moves," I called aloud. And nobody moved. Canuck kept his men close around while he parleyed. Turnock guarded his back. The men speaking for the town consented, under his threats, to give him 5 serf women and 5 boys. They began to argue for time to collect the tribute, as they called it, but that he forbade. "Send them here now, and we will choose what we want," he said, and raised his left hand a little, at which they agreed to his demand. Then came a time that seemed very long to him. While the crowds in the side streets ebbed and then grew again, pressing closer, and he could do nothing but sit his sweating horse and keep a keen eye out for archers and other threats. At last, dismal little groups of boys and women came driven through the streets to the marketplace, 2 here and 3 there, weeping and pleading, some even crawling on their hands and knees, goaded forward by whips and kicks. There were 5 boys in all, none of them more than 10 years old, and 4 women. 2 little serf girls half dead with fear, and 2 older women with stained, stinking clothing, who came without being driven, maybe thinking life among the witch folk could not be worse than life as a tanner's slave. And that was all. Canuck thought it unwise to insist on a better selection to choose from. The longer he was here so hugely outnumbered, the nearer to the time when somebody in the mob of people shot an arrow or threw a stone that hit its mark, and then the crowd would tear them all to pieces. All the same, he would not be bilked by these merchants. "There are 4 women only," he said. The parleyers whined and argued. His time was short. He looked about the marketplace and the big houses around it. He saw a woman's face in the window of a narrow house at the corner. She wore a willow green color that had caught his eye before. She was not hiding, but standing right in the window looking down at him. "Her," he said, pointing. He pointed with his right hand, but all the people gasped and cowered. That made him laugh. He moved his right hand slowly across the watching faces in a pretense of unmaking them all. The door of the corner house opened, and the woman in willow green came out and stood on the step. She was young, small, and thin. Her long hair lay black on her green gown. "Will you be my wife?" Canuck said to her. She stood still. "Yes," she said, and came walking slowly across the ruined marketplace to him. She wore strapped black slippers. He held his left hand down to her. She stepped in the stirrup, and he swung her up into the saddle before him. "The mules and their gear are yours," he called out to the townsmen, mindful of the gift's gift. From his poverty it was indeed a great gift, though the people of Dunnet may well have taken it for a final insolence. His men had each taken one of the serfs up to ride double with them, and so they set out, riding sedately, in order, the crowds falling away from them in silence, through the street, out from between the house walls, onto the northern road, seeing the mountains before them. So ended the last raid on the lowlands from Caspermont. Neither Canuck nor his bride ever went down that road again. She was named Mella Olitta. She owned the willow green dress, the little black slippers she stood in, and a tiny opal on a silver chain around her neck. That was her dowry. He married her 4 nights after he brought her home to the stone house. His mother and the housewomen had readied clothing and other things proper for a bride to have, in great haste and with a good will. Brantor Auric married them in the hall of the stone house. With all the members of the raiding troop present, and all the people of Caspermont, and whoever could come from the domains of the West to dance at the wedding. "And then," I said, when my father had finished the story, "mother had me." Mella Olida was born and grew up in Derris Water, fourth of the five daughters of a priest magistrate of the civic religion of Bendramin. It is a high office, and the priest magistrate and his wife were well off, bringing up their daughters in leisure and luxury, though very strictly. For the state religion demands modesty, chastity, and obedience of women, and is full of penances and humiliations for those who disobey. Audild Olida was a kindly and indulgent father. His highest hope for his girls was that they should be dedicated virgins in the city temple. Mella was taught reading, writing, some mathematics, a great deal of holy history and poetry, and the elements of urban surveying and architecture, as preparation for that honorable career. She liked learning and was an excellent pupil. But when she was 18, something went awry. Something occurred. I don't know what. She never said. She only smiled and passed over the matter. Maybe her tutor fell in love with her and she was blamed for it. Maybe she had a sweetheart and stole out to meet him. Maybe it was a smaller matter even than that. Not the least shadow of a scandal may touch a postulant virgin of the city temple, on whose purity the prosperity of all Bendramin depends. I have wondered if Mella may have engineered a little scandal in order to escape the city temple. In any case, she was sent to stay with distant cousins in the north, in the remote and rural town of Dunnet. They too were respectable, proper people, who kept her closer than ever while they bargained and chicaned with local families for a suitable husband for her, and brought the candidates in to look her over. "One of them," she said, "was a little fat man with a pink nose who trafficked in pigs. Another of them was a tall, tall, thin, thin boy who prayed for an hour 11 times a day. He wanted me to pray with him." So she looked out of the window and saw Cannock of Caspermont astride his red stallion, destroying men and houses with a glance. As he chose her, she chose him. "How did you make your cousins let you go?" I asked, knowing the answer, savoring it in advance. "They were all lying down on the floor under the furniture, so that the witch warrior couldn't see them and melt their bones and destroy them." I said, "Don't fear, cousin. Is it not said, a virgin shall save thy house and goods?" And I went downstairs and outside. "How did you know father wouldn't destroy you?" "I knew," she said. She had no more idea of where she was going and what she was getting into than Cannock had when he rode down out of the mountains expecting Dunnet to be like our villages. A few huts and hovels, a cattle pen, and 9 or 10 inhabitants, all gone hunting. Probably she thought she was going to something not very different from her father's house, or at least her cousin's house. A cleanly, warm, bright place full of company and comforts. How could she have known? To lowlanders, the uplands are an accursed, forgotten corner of a world they left behind long ago. They know nothing of them. A warlike people might have sent an army up to clear out these fearsome, irksome remnants of the past. But Bendramin and Urdala are lands of merchants, farmers, scholars, and priests, not warriors. All they did was turn their back on the mountains and forget them. "Even in Dunnet," my mother said, "many people no longer believed in the tales of the men of the Carantages, goblin hordes sweeping down on the cities of the plain, monsters on horseback who set whole fields aflame with a sweep of the hand and withered an army with a glance of the eye." "All that was long ago," when Cumbelow was king. Nothing like that happened these days. People used to trade from Dunnet for the fine, cream-white upland cattle, they told her, but the breed had all but died out. The land was terribly poor up there. Nobody lived on the old upland domains, but poor herdsmen and shepherds and farmers scratching a living out of stone. And that was, as my mother found, the truth, or a substantial part of it. But there were many kinds of truth in my mother's view of things, as many kinds as there were tales to tell. All the adventures and the stories she told us as children happened when Cumbelow was king. The brave young priest knights who defeated devils in the shape of huge dogs, the fearsome witch folk of the Carantages, the talking fish that warned of earthquake, the beggar girl who got a flying cart made out of moonlight. They were all of the time when Cumbelow was king. The rest of her stories were not adventures at all, except for that one, the story in which she herself stepped out of a door and walked across a marketplace. There the two lines of story crossed. The two truths met. Her stories without adventures were mere descriptions of the tame doings of a stuffy household in a middle-sized city in a sleepy country of the lowlands. I loved them as well or better than the adventures. I demanded them. Tell about Derriswater. And I think she liked to talk about it not only to please me, but to tease and appease her homesickness. She was always a stranger among strange folk, however much she loved them and was beloved. She was merry, joyous, active, full of life. But I know one of her greatest happinesses was to curl up with me on rugs and cushions in front of the small hearth in her sitting room, the round room in the tower, and tell me what they sold in the markets of Derriswater. She told how she and her sisters used to spy on their father getting dressed in all his corsets and paddings and robes and overrobes as priest magistrate, and how he wobbled walking in the high-soled shoes that made him taller than other men, and how, when he took off the shoes and robes, he shrank. She told how she had gone with family friends on a boat that sailed clear down the Trond to its mouth where it ran out into the sea. She told me of the sea. She told me that the snail stones we found in quarries and used for gaming pieces were living creatures down on the ocean shore, delicate, colored, shining. My father would come in from his farm work to her room, with clean hands and in clean shoes, for she held firmly to certain principles new to the stone house, and he would sit with us, listening. He loved to listen to her. She talked like a little stream running, clearly and merrily, with a lowland softness and fluency. To people in the cities, talk is an art and a pleasure, not a matter of mere use and need. She brought that art and pleasure to Caspermont. She was the light of my father's eyes.